So, Dr. Pete, thanks so much for joining us again.
Mm-hmm.
For those perhaps people who've never heard you, would you give an outline of your academic and professional background so that people can understand the work that you've been doing?
First, I studied for a master's degree at University of Oregon in literature-related things, and then studied linguistics for a while. Finally came back to study biology, 1968 to 72, specializing in physiology of reproduction and aging, and especially the biochemical side of aging physiology.
Okay. All right. So I wanted to ask you some questions about your most recent newsletter, which was based on nitric oxide, and hopefully open it up for people to understand the context in which we're talking about as a product. I think the very first question that I wanted to pose, given that the compound manufactured by Pfizer will be well known to many, both in its generic form and in the off-counter or other brand label types of product, being Viagra. So nitric oxide has a vasodilatory effect, as I understand it. And that's just one of them, though. I guess that's mediated by Viagra. And that drug is approved, or has an FDA approval, for erectile dysfunction. What is it about nitric oxide that makes it so dangerous and responsible for things like cardiac arrest, stroke, arrhythmias, and also increased ocular pressure, which most people wouldn't even associate with Viagra? But I've had several people who have used it and have had heart attack and stroke. And that prompted me to even look at it as being something that it should definitely be taken seriously. And I know also the kind of recreational drug users who use poppers, exactly the same compound, has some very damaging effects on the body. What's your take on nitric oxide?
Speaking of poppers, several of the early theorists of AIDS were blaming it on whatever the chemical is. I guess it's nitric oxide that's produced from the poppers.
Right.
Some kind of nitric compound, anyway.
Yeah.
And they were arguing that that in itself was enough to account for the AIDS among the people who were using that as a pleasure drug.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 1980s, everyone knew nitric oxide primarily as a toxic component of smog. And so when people started discovering that it was being produced in small amounts in the body, immediately they started looking for the parallels with smog poisoning, a lung injury, a circulatory disease, and so on. And one of the first things they found was that it kills the beta cells in the pancreas that produce insulin. And so in the early 1940s, there was this flurry of papers demonstrating that our internal smog is just as toxic as Los Angeles smog. But then the Viagra patent and publicity came out in the later 1990s. And right then, suddenly the medical publications all found that it was a glorious, protective, natural, protecting just about every function you can think of, making you smarter, have more endurance, and all kinds of good things. But then, after a few years, I guess the investment in publicity started wearing off, and people started coming back to the diabetes-producing effects and looking at what it's actually doing biochemically. Basic way it causes harm probably is that it is kind of parallel to the effects of carbon monoxide or cyanide in being a competitor for oxygen in the mitochondria, the enzymes that produce most of our energy. It, in several ways, knocks out not only the key final respiratory enzyme, cytochrome oxidase, but it poisons the previous electron transporting parts of the mitochondria too. So simply turning off the energy supply can account for a lot of its problems. But it also, when you're stopping the oxidative run through the mitochondrion, the mitochondrion starts leaking, in effect, electrons that have no place to go, and the whole cell shifts over to a reduced chemical state. The electrons aren't being constantly drawn down, and so the balance, if you imagine a stream of electrons falling steadily towards oxygen, when you cut off that, they accumulate and float back, and literally the reducing environment shifts the whole balance of the self-reduced sulfur compounds, and it's expressed all the way out to the surface, and the surface properties of the cell change. And there are some enzymes right at the, across the surface, so that this reducing energy from inside the cell is available to reduce oxygen outside the cell, since the mitochondria aren't using it productively. In fact, this cloud of excess electrons flows through the enzyme called NADPH oxidase and directly reduces oxygen on the surface. And that produces superoxide, possibly toxic free radical, which then produces hydrogen peroxide. And in the immune cells that are under stress, that's considered productive because it helps to break down bacteria or whatever is exciting, disturbing the white blood cell. So this toxic oxidative burst has its useful aspects, but probably it's one of the better outcomes rather than just using the hydrogen peroxide directly or producing nitric oxide. This hydrogen peroxide can be used to oxidize chloride that is always present into hypochlorite, which becomes one of the very strong germ-digesting chemicals that when the phagocyte has eaten something, then is basically it's like Clorox. It helps to break down the particle.
Okay, so in general, the nitric oxide forms a pretty energy-wasteful mechanism and also damaging in its free radical-producing effects.
This shift of the whole cell away from oxidation starts that whole process that people are still just starting to put together the whole picture of how it fits into physiology, but it has its effects on the nervous system that people are now seeing that Parkinson's disease, for example, has the signs that nitric oxide is one of the central damaging components of the dopamine system.
Okay. All right, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMED Galvo 91.1 FM. From 7:30 till the end of the show, 8 o'clock, callers are invited to ask questions about this month's subject of nitric oxide and the ramifications thereof. doesn't have to be specifically about this subject. I know people often call in about other subjects that Dr. Pete's well-versed in, like thyroid, etc. But the number here, if you're in the area, is 923-3911. Or if you're outside the area, there's a toll-free number, which is 1-800-KMUD-RAD. So, so far as the damaging effects of nitrogen nitric oxide are concerned, I think there was three species of nitric oxide, and the one I think that's most commonly referenced in PubMed and other scientific literature for its effects, both negative and for that small beneficial effect of its energy burst effect on bacteria, etc., is the inducible nitric oxide synthase. And that's been implicated in causing an increased severity of disease in quite a few different models, one of which was a herpes simplex model, encephalitis, which is a brain inflammation in mice. And then there, I saw other references as well to chronic viral hepatitis in man as definitely being aggravated by nitric oxide, and potentially nitric oxide suppression might be a useful treatment for people suffering from chronic hepatitis. What are the most reasonable ways of blocking nitric oxide synthesis in the body, or at least managing its production and providing a buffer to it so that you can maintain the little nitric oxide that is beneficial whilst keeping in check any excess?
The body has its various natural ways of keeping it under control. For example, progesterone inhibits the enzyme that makes nitric oxide, while estrogen excites and activates that enzyme. And so when the cell is stabilized by a generous amount of progesterone and the related neurosteroids, the stabilizing things, mm-hmm. Including pregnenolone, those hold down the production. Anything that irritates the cell and excites it, the endotoxin from the intestine is probably the biggest single constant promoter of the production of nitric oxide. And sometimes serotonin and histamine, which are produced in reaction to endotoxin and other irritating things, these can increase in various tissues. Serotonin and histamine can increase the formation of nitric oxide. In some situations, caffeine and similar drugs that are known to have a variety of protective antitoxic effects are acting by locally in a certain type of tissue, turning down the nitric oxide production. But in recent years, the old dye, it was used as a treatment for malaria 100 years ago, called methylene blue. It's a common lab chemical used for showing the presence of a reducing compound. For example, vitamin C turns it white.
Okay.
And, lots of people use it to demonstrate chemistry in a visible form. It's being used for a tremendous variety of therapeutic purposes, and simply by turning down nitric oxide, which causes so many bad effects. Methylene blue is having very positive effects in this great variety of things, including herpes and other viral, chronic viral diseases. The recent news about the Ebola virus, some people have noticed that one of the things, if the patient is going to die, their nitric oxide level in the blood is very high, and it's what is causing the blood vessels to leak mm-hmm. and break down, causing blood to leak out every place that it shouldn't. But you see something similar in ordinary influenza and other viral infections. The blood vessels tend to become leaky and produce swelling and a lot of very common side effects that you see in diseases of all sorts.
What would you think would be a good short-term approach to that, to block that?
From the what's available presently, niacin, amide, and progesterone are things that are commonly available, but methylene blue is probably, when it's available, it's probably a good emergency thing to turn off the massive amounts of overproduced nitric oxide.
I did read an article. I think there were several references to methylene blue and its use either promoting or suppressing, depending on a dose. And it seemed like very small amounts of methylene blue were having this favorable suppressive activity, where larger amounts could actually cause...
some of the toxicity experiments have been kind of ridiculous, in which they feed rats the equivalent if you, for a person, it would be an ounce or two of crystalline methylene blue,
okay.
Which it would just that amount of concentrated any chemical is going to be harmful. But it's been 25 years ago, someone did a very well-controlled study of severe depressed people.
Uh-huh.
And, 15 milligrams per day was all it took to relieve severe depression.
Uh-huh.
And the side effects of even many times higher doses than that are essentially zero. Two studies, one by the NIH 6 years ago and one more recent, gave graded doses up to what would be the equivalent of about 4 or 5 or 6 grams a day for a person of the crystalline material, many times higher than the curative antidepressive dose. And they did it for the whole lifespan of rats and mice and saw no life-shortening effects in either rats or mice, but in female mice, in both studies, they saw an extension of the maximum lifespan with the highest dose. And so in these ridiculously high doses, many times, I guess about 5 to 10 times yeah. higher than the dose Paul Ehrlich used more than 100 years ago to treat malaria.
Okay.
And he cured 2 cases of malaria in a period of just a couple of weeks, giving 5 doses a day of 100 milligrams each time orally. But with very much smaller doses, you see changes in the brain and reduced stress and curing depression and so on. But with several times higher doses than he used to cure malaria, you still don't see any harmful effects. And in animal experiments, it took one of the gigantic doses equivalent to, I think it was about 8 grams a day for a person before it stopped showing the simple antidepressive actions.
Wow. Now, do you think the effects of methylene blue are, there's probably multiple effects, but I wonder if any of the electron quenching or electrical stabilizing activity of methylene blue might be responsible for interacting with different proteins and
one of the known mechanisms is that it can receive electrons
right.
from the mediator that receives them from glucose, and NADH, for example, can be oxidized, and then the methylene blue can pass those electrons on to the part of the mitochondrion that is still working, bypassing damaged parts of the mitochondrion. So it can act like the missing enzyme, simply restoring mitochondrial function.
Yeah,
but in subtler ways, it, for example, the receptor that causes excitotoxic damage from overdoses of glutamic acid, for example, anything that is depleting the brain of energy while stimulating it activates these glutamate receptors. And there are two sulfur groups in those proteins that respond to excitotoxins, that methylene blue oxidizes those and turns off the receptor and stops the excitotoxic process. And that's one of the ways, the excitotoxic process is one of the things that turns on nitric oxide production, going ahead and killing the cell. That's why the excited state is toxic, largely because of the production of nitric oxide.
Okay, now I guess methylene blue, it's not an FDA-controlled substance or anything. I think it's fairly fairly widely available. It's just a dye, isn't it? I think typically it's known as a dye. I know it's a tissue stain.
And fish stores use it. I'm not sure how they use it, but it's for sterilizing aquariums or something. And fish farmers use it to cure various fish infections.
Okay. Well, people listening perhaps might want to start looking up methylene blue and its implications in the treatment and or prevention of different degenerative conditions. So extremely cheap, I'm sure. Not at all patented, not controlled. And if there's some good studies coming out showing methylene blue's positive effects in blocking nitric oxide, I think that could be well worth people looking at as an alternative to many of the drugs that people might be using for different conditions. Okay.
I've counted about six different ways that methylene blue stops or blocks the production of nitric oxide.
Okay, go on. Do you want to share them or?
No.
Okay.
The excitotoxic thing was one.
Yeah.
Of preventing excess polymerization of the microtubules.
Okay.
Another. Probably increasing progesterone production. Inhibiting estrogen production. But probably the most important thing people should do is to start being critical about the tremendous amount of propaganda selling the idea that people should eat more arginine to increase their nitric oxide production.
Wow. Yeah. I don't know. It always amazes me how this stuff actually comes into circulation as quote common knowledge, and how easily influenced the media is by big pharma. Anyway, not to go on too much about that, because we could probably go on forever about how big pharma have their hooks all over. Anyway, it's coming up for 7:30. I've seen the lights flashing a couple of times, and I don't know if anyone's on the line at the moment. No shaking his head, must have gone off. Okay, no problem. Well, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Galbraith 91.1 FM. From now until the end of the show at 8 o'clock, you're invited to call him with any questions, either related or unrelated to this month's subject of nitric oxide, and how to control its damaging effects. Dr. Raymond Peet is with us in the studio. He's a pretty foremost authority on lots of different subjects surrounding hormones and aging and all the interactions of thereon. And he's with us in the show, so we'll be we have a caller on the line already. Look at that. Okay, caller, you're on the air. And where are you from?
I'm from Southern Humboldt here.
Okay.
Yeah. John. I I wanted to know if all of the estrogen imitators that are around us in the environment that we've created for ourselves to live in are also something that'll put us at risk.
Very much so, yeah.
I think I've seen that bisphenol A activates nitric oxide production.
There you go, and that's an estrogen promoter or mimic. Yeah, okay, so environmental estrogens, very much a negative impact on our health, many of which have come from petrochemical industry, plastics industry, etc. Dr. Pete, what do you think some of the most damaging environmental estrogens that you know of that are?
The natural estrogen is...
it's damaging enough.
Yeah, it's through the sewage. It's getting into the rivers.
Uh-huh.
And for the environment, I think that the natural estrogen and the birth control estrogens that are many times stronger than natural estrogen,
and that's
are
coming
showing
into...
up in all of the downstream waterways that receive sewage.
So wastewater management does not selectively remove hormones from the water, then? Are you saying that it's found? I wonder if it's reasonable to posit that there is detectable amounts in drinking water even.
Well, as a sewer board person, I can tell you that one of the ways that they tell whether water is coming from a sewage system or from nature is they look for caffeine. That's considered one of the chemicals that makes it through and is a marker for sewage as opposed to, you know, animal waste or whatever. So, yeah, a lot of those chemicals do make it through.
Mm. Okay, did we have any other questions?
Well, yeah, the other part of my question was, is there a plant or an herb that actually produces or mimics methylene blue that you can ingest instead of...
Oh, I've been looking around at various molecules, and it was a precursor for many of the drugs, the tricyclic antidepressants and tricyclic antihistamines and anti-inflammatories. I think all grew out of the dye industry that methylene blue was one of the very first examples of, but... it's a three-ring molecule, and that seems probably because it's structurally roughly the same size and shape as the steroid hormones. It probably can get into the many the places that are natural steroids act. And so I've looked around at plants that make analogous things. The tetracyclines have many of the same anti-inflammatory effects. I suspect they're also working against nitric oxide. They just have one extra ring, but in a very similar arrangement. And vitamin K and vitamin E are even analogous in some ways. Lapacho, a chemical from a South American tree, has it's a dye that has many of the anti-inflammatory, anti-cancer properties of methylene blue.
Spell that.
As Lapacho is a tababui impetiginosa, so T-A-B-E-B-U-I-A, tababui, and impetiginosa is South American tall South American hardwood, but it's used extensively for cancer, as Dr. Pete mentioned. They call it Pau de Arco.
And recently people are talking about a thing, an Asian herb. I think one of the names is black cumin, but it contains thymoquinone, and the quinones are, I think, the essential model of the protective pro-oxidant stabilizing chemical. And thymoquinone is considered to be a very powerful anti-inflammatory. And I suspect that it'll turn out to be acting against excess nitric oxide.
So it's a free radical quencher again, isn't it, the quinones? Are they have
Yeah, that's just one of their, right. their many. Right. They seem to activate the right kind of oxidation while quenching the bad kind.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Well, we do have.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for your caller, caller. We have three callers on the lines here, so let's get them one after the other. Caller, you're on the air. Where are you from?
Me?
Hi, you're on the air. Where are you from?
Hi, Arcata.
Arcata, okay. Go ahead. Yeah. What's your question?
Thanks. I've been listening to your show for a good 4 years or so. A couple of quick review questions from the past that I've been wondering about for a long time. It was mentioned some time ago about a nutrient, I believe, that could help remediate or, you know, fix the earlobe crease. Does that ring any bell?
What was the last thing you said?
Earlobe crease?
Oh, the earlobe.
Earlobe crease, yeah.
That's a thyroid deficiency then, huh?
Yeah, I think it is mainly a thyroid deficiency.
Okay, and did I hear at the time a simple recommendation for correction of that? Was there a nutrient, or is that a much more complex matter to address?
I think the main thing causing hypothyroidism in so many people is an excess of the polyunsaturated fatty acids, because they're able to block the production of thyroid, its transport, and its action. So they're very capable of antagonizing thyroid function.
So to avoid all the nuts and seeds that contain liquid oils in them, so nuts and seeds are principally the kind of polyunsaturated sources, and obviously there are other polyunsaturates that are commonly available in food that you should definitely avoid. So any of the liquid oils... obviously.
What about like coconut oil? Is that cool?
Coconut oil is saturated, so that's good. That's okay. Dr. Pete's always recommending coconut oil and butter as being the two saturated sources of fat that should be the most consumed, and then to avoid all the liquids, liquid polyunsaturates, obviously fish oil being the worst.
Okay. Like cod liver oil?
Is that too. But I think, Dr. Pete, don't you say that the vitamin content in cod liver oil.
If you don't have any better source, cod liver oil is a great source of vitamin D.
Yeah.
But it's better to get sunlight.
Yeah.
Okay. Quick other question?
Go ahead.
There was something that came up about eating carrots, and I don't know what the term would be, but I want to say like an astringent or a cleaning or purifying or
antiseptic
aspect of eating carrots, but it was recommended that it be that carrots be cut diagonally. And as a juicer and a cook, I guess, of my own food, I thought that was a bit peculiar, and I wondered if that could be elaborated upon.
Now, I think Dr. Pete's always mentioned that grated carrots to increase the surface area is the mechanism that's preferred, and that's basically as a antiseptic, if you like, for the gut, removing excess estrogen and other waste products, and it's undigested, so has a pretty good action in the gut without physically being changed.
But like chewing it is not enough to enhance the surface area, like breaking it down?
Well, not the same, because ultimately when you grate the product in a grater, then you obviously have a big surface area then, and whatever you chew that up from then is going to increase it still.
The juice does contain a lot of good things, but if you throw away the fiber, you're losing the most important thing for stimulating and cleaning the intestine.
Cool.
Thanks for your call. I've got a couple more callers here, so let's take the next caller. Where are you from?
I'm from Southern Humboldt.
Okay, go ahead. What's your question?
Well, I've got a couple of questions. First, did you say that L-arginine was bad? I've heard that that was supposed to be good for you, but I'm not sure what it's supposed to do.
Okay, Dr. P, arginine, you mentioned it a moment ago as being...
And
is there a difference between arginine and L-arginine?
The internet is just swamped with... advertisements for ways to supplement arginine. L-arginine is just the natural amino acid, but if you get more than you need, it will increase your tendency to overproduce nitric oxide. And too much tryptophan happens to boost that, and possibly by increasing serotonin, but it's very important to keep your amino acids in a good balance, especially avoiding too much cysteine, tryptophan, methionine, and arginine.
So you don't recommend taking an L-arginine supplement?
No, I think it's very dangerous.
Oh, okay. Now, did you say that Viagra is bad for you because it's made out of this nitric oxide stuff?
It inhibits an enzyme that is supposed to inactivate a substance made by the production of nitric oxide. Nitric oxide starts a chain reaction, and Viagra keeps that chain reaction going. And in the process, it ends up systemically increasing not only the effect of nitric oxide, but even in some situations, the level of nitric oxide. So it probably is increasing the aging process, basically, in brain, heart, pancreas, everywhere you get an excess of nitric oxide.
But they say having sex is good for you. If you can't have sex, that's not so great either. I mean, is it a matter of moderation and not using it too often? Can it be okay if you use some of it? I mean, I don't know. I'm not a man.
Well, it's one of the essential amino acids, and so if you eat any good high-quality protein, even potatoes, milk, cheese, you're going to get all of the arginine you need.
No, I'm talking about Viagra now.
Oh, Viagra.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, is that, like, totally bad, or is it okay, you know, to have some of it? Because I'm saying if that improves the sexual function, you know, of an older man, then sexual function is supposed to be a good thing.
Well, Dr. Pete,
there a balance there, or do you think it's totally bad?
I think it would be better to work on the actual physiological problem, improving natural circulation, and, for example, restoring good thyroid function will often increase libido and potency.
Now, Dr. Pete, I remember now some time ago you also mentioning pregnenolone and or progesterone as being very positive. I mean, I in the past, it always talked about progesterone potentially being slightly sedative and maybe decreasing. I think, now you have said this, let me quote you. I think you said decreasing penis size, but it does not block the vasodilatory ability, and so therefore actually does promote and enable erection, and actually is a reasonably safe way of doing that in males.
Well, what about testosterone?
One thing at a time, huh?
Aging men have decreased amounts of testosterone and progesterone and increasing amounts of estrogen, and that increased estrogen and the decreased amounts of the protective steroids, I think, will increase the tendency to have erectile problems. And one of the really odd side effects of increased nitric oxide is that it decreases the ability to make testosterone. Hmm. And at least in women, it lowers the progesterone synthesis. But those are synthesized very similarly. So I think in both men and women, nitric oxide is opposing and lowering those protective steroids while increasing estrogen.
Well, what about Cialis? Is that just the same as Viagra? There's several mm-hmm. products on the market that are supposed to help men with their erection.
It's another version.
Are they all the same?
Yeah, pretty much.
Mm. All right, well, okay. Thank you.
Yep, thanks for your call. Okay, Dr. P, I wanted to ask you some more questions about nitric oxide and or some of the articles that I've seen about it promoting cancer. What are your thoughts on the cancer-promoting effects of nitric oxide?
I think it's one of the central factors in keeping cancer going,
mm-hmm.
and so turning it off.
You don't necessarily think it's a promoter, then, in as much as...
Oh, yeah, it is a definite promoter of cancer growth and metastasis.
Okay.
Many publications are now recognizing that breast cancer, prostate cancer, and probably every cancer will probably eventually be discovered to respond badly to nitric oxide.
Hmm. Okay.
Function of anything interfering with respiration, that's where the Warburg hypothesis was, that simply shifting away from oxygen as the energy source to being able to produce too much lactic acid even when there's oxygen, because the cell has lost its mitochondrial function.
Right.
Nitric oxide and carbon monoxide are both able to knock out the mitochondrial function and imitate the cancer metabolism. And there are several recent publications showing that the Warburg cancer metabolism is created by nitric oxide excess, and it's turned off by methylene blue, simply by turning off the production of nitric oxide.
Okay, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Garberville, 91.1 FM. From now till the end of the show, 8 o'clock, we're pleased to have Dr. Raymond Peake joining us on the show. The number here is 923-3911, or if you live outside the area, there's a toll-free number, which is 1-800-KMUD-RAD. So, Dr. Peake, again, I had a question on my mind during this week, that reading different research on different diseases, and apart from that, knowing that some individuals are just inherently more able to enjoy good health, seemingly against all odds, have you any understanding of why some individuals, for example, are immune to HIV? Some individuals mount a successful response against hepatitis. Some individuals just have an innate immunity which enables them to overcome what it is they come into contact with, and they don't suffer from it. Do you think there's any connection between anything that you've read that you know about that you might be able to explain that from?
There are new ideas about the whole functioning of the immune system that have been coming up in the last 20 years. Jamie Cunliffe and Polly Matzinger mm-hmm. are the leading figures in that view of the immune system. And I see it as imagining the body as an ecosystem which is simply so strong in some people at maintaining its own organization and stability that when something extraneous like a bacterium or a virus or a cancer cell happens to invade it, the situation is so tightly organized in favor of maintaining the host organism mm-hmm. that the invader can't find a place. It's the niches are all occupied doing business with the owner of the property. There's uh-huh. simply no place to camp out.
Like the strong man in the house, no one can invade it.
Yeah, and I don't see it as a killing of the invader, but simply as using up all of the electron space productively so that
keeping the door shut.
Can't do strange things with it, like turning sugar into lactic acid.
Okay. I'd love to be able to get into the subject that I saw posted last thing today, and that was to quote what I've said before many times, and I think has been repeated through generations, that you are what you eat. I think I'd love to get into that subject with you next month. I think we have another caller on the air anyway, but I'd love to get into that subject next month and just show that what we hear sometimes really does mean a lot more than we take for granted, and that actually a lot of the things that are passed down from old generations to now really have their roots in fundamental science, and that science now is at last being able to bear that out. So let me just get this other caller on the air, and then we'll carry on.
Actually, two simple questions coming through me.
Okay.
First one is MSM, and does it have an influence on male or female libido?
Okay, Dogs Pete. Methylene sulfmethone, is it?
I believe.
Yeah. I'm very cautious about it. Dimethyl sulfide, I think, has its uses, but I'm not sure that there's anything really fully safe with MSM.
And what about DCA or dichloroacetate for cancers?
That happens to be very similar to methylene blue in the way it is essentially non-toxic in moderate amounts. People are now getting as much as 10 or 12 grams of it per day intravenously and feeling great. But what it does is restore the productive oxidation of glucose, getting the electrons to go all the way from glucose to form carbon dioxide, pretty much what methylene blue is doing in different situations. But the DCA is reversing the cancer metabolism, or the so-called Warburg metabolism, the same way that methylene blue does. So I see it as a very important way of making up for the toxic effects of nitric oxide, endotoxin, free radical fat oxidation, and so on.
And you've spoken of antioxidants that are too strong. Could you maybe give a spectrum of antioxidants and say, is ALA too strong, or what is the strongest antioxidant you would recommend? And THC in that spectrum as well?
Vitamin E and ascorbic acid in the right proportion and the right situation are very safe and constructive. Lipoic, alpha-lipoic acid is pretty safe, but I would be very cautious with the acetylcysteine. I think large amounts of it can push the balance in the wrong direction.
Okay. All right. Dr. Pete, I had a question actually from a person who wrote to me who said that they were unable to call in because they were outside the country. And I think by the time I responded to them to ask them what country they were in, it was probably already too late. And I have come across this with other people anyway, in our own practice. And working with you, I think I understand the situation, but I'd like to hear it from you. It was a woman who said that she had hypothyroidism symptoms, including depression, weight gain, cold hands and feet, dry hair and skin. Her TSH, her thyroid stimulating hormone, was 1.6, which wasn't super high, but I know you like it to be as close to zero as possible. And her T3 was 3.5. She said she used to take Armathyroid. She was prescribed this by a doctor, and it helped with symptoms for a few months. And she said that when she tried to supplement with T3 or a T3 and T4 combination, she developed anxiety and tachycardia. She said she's experimented with doses as small even as 1 milligram of T3, and she said it would send her into a hyperthyroid type state. I think that's kind of anxiety and palpitations. It may be an adrenaline thing, but she said, is there anything that she could do to better tolerate thyroid supplementation? She is currently taking zinc, gluconate, vitamin D, vitamin K. She's using 4,000 IU of vitamin D. She's using Progesti, the second half of her menstrual cycle, aspirin, magnesium and calcium. She also eats liver weekly. What do you think might cause that in a person who previously might have used thyroid and then suddenly becomes what they call sensitive to it and unable to use it?
Sometimes I think it's that the product has changed. European forms of thyroid supplement seem to be very unpredictable. But if it's for sure the same product, then usually a magnesium deficiency can cause exactly those symptoms, because the thyroid makes your cells able to use magnesium and so take it up. But a big organ like your skeletal muscles and bones can take up so much from your blood that your brain and heart and such have trouble getting the magnesium they need to respond to the thyroid. And then you get an exaggerated stress and adrenaline reaction. And low cholesterol is another limiting factor. If you have very low cholesterol, you can't respond to increasing your thyroid, because one of the basic functions of thyroid is to turn cholesterol into progesterone, pregnenolone, and DHEA.
Okay, so what kind of dose of magnesium would you think for that kind of person would be suitable?
About 100 milligrams at a time, as you take say 1 or 2 micrograms of Cytomel or Cinomel, 100 micrograms will be plenty for the first 2 or 3 hours of responding to 1 or 2 micrograms.
Okay, and I looked earlier on as I was doing some searching around. I saw that the main principal sources, it seemed, of magnesium were nuts and seeds. There were small amounts, in some in soy. But I think principally, what would you recommend as a good magnesium source?
Fruit juices and coffee, I think, are if you want a really intense source, you can boil leaves like kale or beet greens or something just for 2 or 3 minutes, and the green water that comes out quickly is very concentrated in magnesium and calcium.
Okay, excellent.
That's a very pretty safe supplement.
Yeah.
Coffee and fruit juices are practical and something you can do every day.
Okay. All right. Well, like I said, perhaps next month, if you're available, I'd love to look into that new research. Well, actually, I think it was brought out in mid 1960s by that Korean. It sounded very interesting about the third circulatory system in the body, and actually that you are what you eat, because there is a pretty intimate interaction between food products and our own DNA. They can be switched on and off and regulated. That sounded pretty fascinating.
There's a German group that has been doing this for about 15 years now, looking at the DNA from our foods getting incorporated into our own DNA.
Yeah.
And some biologists have been theorizing about this for the last 100 years. Carl Lindgren was someone who reviewed the topic about 50 years ago, showing good evidence that organisms all across the spectrum are sharing nucleic acid.
Yeah.
Pollen, for example, when you ingest pollen that's blowing in the air, some of the DNA is probably actually getting incorporated into our chromosomes.
Yeah. Well, listen, I want to let people know how to find out more about you if they've not heard about you. So thanks so much for giving your time for the show this evening, Dr. Pete.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so for people who've listened to the show or maybe haven't heard of Dr. Pete before, he's got a wealth of information on his website. It's freely accessible. It's fully referenced scientific material. It's not just made up. It's fully referenced, and there's plenty of articles both on PubMed and other medical research sites to validate what Dr. Pete's saying. It's a science that provides the answers, and it's not what we know in the mainstream media, which is told to us by pharmaceutical companies and other vested interests. But the scientists that are interested in humanitarian causes are definitely finding lots of very novel ways of treating disease. So don't just think that what you see on the television or read in the newspapers is the only way that you can get yourself healthy. So Raymond Peet's website is www.raypeet.com. He's got lots of articles. And for those of you who'd like to get in contact with us during regular business hours, we can be reached on 1-888-WBM-HERB for further information. So until December's show, thanks so much for joining.